Chapter 3. Portland. The Justice Center is a large, multi-level building spanning an entire city block in downtown Portland, Oregon. It houses the Sheriff's Office, Portland Police Central Precinct, courtrooms, and hundreds of inmates in the county jail. To Portland's Black Lives Matter Antifa, it is a physical manifestation of the American rule of law that they despise. As the sun set on Friday, May 29th, 2020, a crowd trekked through downtown Portland toward the Justice Center, their angry faces, shouting ACAB for "All cops are bastards," were illuminated by red flares being carried by Antifa Black Bloc militants. They had been primed for violence through hours of radical speeches led by black separatists in Peninsula Park in North Portland. During their march, protesters surrounded a car and one of them fired a gunshot, injuring the vehicle's passenger. Police could not or would not stop them, and they continued unchallenged to their destination, where their comrades had already been camping out. By 11 p.m, the crowd surrounded the building and transformed into an angry mob. They smashed the windows on the ground floor and flooded in. Staff working inside had to flee for their lives. Dozens smashed computer equipment and furniture using bats and other melee weapons. "Burn this shit down!" they shouted as they started fires. The building was still occupied by hundreds of inmates during the attack. After about 10 minutes, police responded and cleared the majority of rioters from the area, but they simply ran to the business corridor of downtown Portland. There, BLM and Antifa demonstrated their symbiotic relationship seen in other cities affected by rioting earlier in the week. Antifa militants, who are mostly white, took the initiative to break into businesses to initiate a chain reaction. The first businesses rioters descended upon were Portland's flagship Apple Store and Louis Vuitton. Marching together as a mob and shouting, "Expropriate!" they broke inside and looted the stores clean. Video recorded at Louis Vuitton showed Black Bloc militants standing guard at the door they broke while young people rushed in and out with designer bags and wallets. Outside, rioters shut down traffic by starting large street fires, using accelerants and whatever they could steal for tinder, wooden pallets, trash bins, newspapers, and so on. When police tried to respond to the chaos, they were attacked in their vehicles by people using electric scooters as melee weapons. The Apple Store's iconic glass windows were smashed and spray-painted with Antifa messages, ACAB, and its numerical rendering, 1312. As the rioting continued for hours, they next targeted banks, clothing stores, and marijuana dispensaries. Rioters shattered windows using bats, bike locks, skateboards, and other impromptu riot tools. Once inside, they started more fires. In another part of downtown, rioters used a car to ram inside a building. Businesses continued to be looted well into the early hours of the next day. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler declared a state of emergency, but it was of no use. Police and firefighters were completely overwhelmed and surrounded. One officer was injured when he was hit by a thrown incendiary device. A Portland police criminalist responding to a scene was hit in the head with a rock. By the end of the rampage, only 16 people were arrested. One of them went on to be charged by the district attorney for arson and other felony crimes. Amelia Joan Shamrovich, a 25-year-old transsexual, allegedly was busted after her roommates contacted law enforcement. The affidavit reads, "When her roommates asked how Shamrovich started the fires, Shamrovich responded by saying that it is not a conversation for Facebook Messenger and that she will be home soon. A subsequent in-person conversation occurred, and the roommates reported that Shamrovich stated she started the fire using a Molotov cocktail, and she is part of Antifa. Shamrovich was reported to be extremely excited about being labelled a terrorist and was very animated about her hopes that police officers would be killed and injured by the riots. She also stated that she would be going out on another mission and the goal would be to set another fire. Shamrovich was charged with first-degree felony arson, felony criminal mischief, felony riot, and two counts of conspiracy to commit a Class A felony. Her ties to Antifa were never reported in the local and national press. All that occurred on just the first night of rioting in Portland. It continued the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that. For weeks, rioters descended on the Justice Center every night, as if it were a ritual. They'd surround the building, confront the police standing guard, and attack them with projectiles and mortar explosives. Many of them used powerful lasers against police that could burn eyes and cause permanent damage to vision. By the middle of the summer, these lasers became so numerous that the rioters who carried them organized into their own unit, and the protests began to look like laser shows. Light mages, as they were called, stood far behind lines of hundreds of protesters to blind police while their comrades closer up threw projectiles. Mayor Wheeler announced an emergency curfew lasting 3 days following the first night of violence, but again it failed to have much effect. Police were unable to do anything beyond writing curfew citations, nearly all of which were later dropped by the district attorney. At every step of the way, the Portland City Council demonized its police force, accusing them of racism and brutality. City Council members Joanne Hardesty and Chloe Udale were at the forefront of that effort. They pushed for the Portland Police's gun violence reduction team to be dissolved after Floyd's death, claiming it targeted blacks. The mayor gave his support, and the unit was dismantled. In the following months, shootings and homicides in Portland spiked to the highest levels in decades. Compared to the year prior, shootings in July and August 2020 in Portland increased by almost 200%. Meanwhile, the daily violent Antifa protests were becoming more organized and sophisticated. Media pundits inaccurately described what was happening as spontaneous and organic. But what I saw on Antifa social media accounts was a deliberate, strategic, and organized plan to grow and entrench the riots. Through advertising on Reddit, Instagram, Snapchat, and Twitter, they were widely successful in getting support not just from Antifa fans, but also from the wider left. In September 2020, Rutgers-affiliated researchers released a study that examined the use of social media by Antifa, referred to in the paper as anarcho-socialists, in instigating widespread violence during the months of unrest throughout the year. They found evidence of systematic online mobilization and radicalization using memes, rage posts, and coded language. These types of extreme anti-police content grew more than 1,000% on Twitter and 300% on Reddit. The study identified that the Youth Liberation Front, YLF, the Antifa group in Portland that took the lead in organizing riots, used cyber swarming to coordinate real-world direct action. Cyber swarming is the act of calling online followers to a real-life location or event. Antifa traditionally use it to immediately mobilize a crowd against people they perceive to be ideological threats. But in 2020, they were using it to direct people to locations to riot. The YLF released daily meeting locations, tactical plans, and maps on Twitter and Telegram. When they put out a call to meet at the George Washington statue in northeast Portland on June 18, 2020, their followers obliged. That evening, dozens of people lit the 100-year-old bronze statue on fire and used rope to pull it down. At the base of the statue, they wrote, "White Fragility" and "BLM." On the toppled statue itself, they spray-painted 1619, referencing the New York Times Magazine's 1619 project. Instead of repairing the damage, the city removed the statue. By November 2020, far-left rioters in Portland toppled or destroyed seven more statues, including one of Thomas Jefferson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Abraham Lincoln. They also set a downtown museum on fire. No one was ever arrested over the vandalism. Mutual aid. To achieve their goals, Antifa use violence. But sustained, effective violence takes organization, planning, and money, in addition to participants. To achieve this, a smorgasbord of ad hoc Antifa groups popped up. Describing themselves as mutual aid groups, they supplied everything from food and bail money to riot gear and weapons. The Witches was one mutual aid group that formed to give out water, food, and supplies to rioters. Riot Ribs was a pop-up kitchen that cooked hot meals. Free food is a mainstay of the riots for a few reasons. It draws in protesters and vagrants to inflate crowd numbers. Secondly, it is effective for propaganda as it generates favorable news stories and photographs showing the peaceful side of the radical protests. The Equitable Workers Offering Community Support, or EWOKS, provided volunteer street medics for comrades injured during rioting. Similarly, a group calling itself OHSU4BLM claimed to be made of medical students affiliated with the Oregon Health and Science University. They later shut down after receiving notice that they weren't allowed to use the OHSU brand. PDX Shield provided homemade shields, which were more frequently used as battering weapons. PDX Hydration Station distributed sticks and umbrellas, tools used to fight police and block cameras, respectively. PDX Community Jail Support aided arrested rioters immediately after their release from jail. They set up a camp outside the Central Police Precinct and offered arrestees food, phone access, legal support, and rides home. In short, they streamlined the riot catch-and-release process. These and numerous other anonymous mutual aid groups were all established between May and August 2020 in Portland. Using payment applications, Venmo and Cash App, the groups were able to raise hundreds of thousands of dollars from a large number of anonymous donors around the country and even internationally. Thousands around the United States support Antifa and the far left. They are willing to donate to their fundraisers. Politicians and celebrities promote their causes, and local media provide favorable coverage. Riot Ribs was one of the most successful Portland Antifa mutual aid groups during the summer. It raised more than $330,000, but suddenly dissolved overnight in July 2020 and disappeared along with the money. Of course, as much money as these mutual aid groups receive to provide supplies to rioters, they pale in comparison to how much the Portland General Defense Committee was able to raise on GoFundMe. Similar to the wildly successful Minnesota Freedom Fund, which bails out rioters and those charged with serious crimes like murder, the Portland group pulled in over $1.37 million. The huge flow of cash is used to bail out every rioter arrested, cover their legal expenses, pay for housing and new mobile devices, give donations to other groups, and whatever else they feel like supporting. When the charges get dropped or dismissed, and the overwhelming majority of them do, the bail bond is returned and reinvested in other nefarious causes. The Portland General Defense Committee publishes a financial accountability page on its website. I can only assume the information reported is accurate. They say $20,000 was given to a bail fund in Eugene, Oregon, Bail bonds ranging from several hundred dollars up to $50,000 were paid for more than 100 people. In effect, the group is using a GoFundMe campaign to channel money to causes that are otherwise not allowed on the platform. The site's terms of service prohibit raising legal funds for those accused of violent crimes. But the Portland General Defense Committee does exactly that, as people they bail out are accused of felony assault and other serious crimes. And what exactly is the General Defense Committee? It is a local chapter of the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW Defense Committee. The IWW is an anarchist socialist labor union. Like the other Antifa mutual aid groups, those involved use pseudonyms and monikers. However, the Portland chapter is a registered non-profit with the state of Oregon. Its filing with the Oregon Secretary of State shows the registered agent behind the group is Catherine Corbin Belier. Belier is one of the people who I allege had assaulted me in June 2019 at the Antifa riot, according to a criminal complaint. Before I was punched in the head by the mob, Belier threw a cup full of liquid in my face. A photographer captured the moment. It shows Belier grinning widely. During the summer of 2020, the Antifa organizing infrastructure was now in place. They had everything they needed to be on autopilot: a plan, people, supplies, and money. In June, the city put up a protective fence around the Justice Center and the adjacent federal courthouse. In response, rioters came with tools to cut the fence open. Every night, police guarding the facilities were hit by hundreds of projectiles. When rioters ran out of supplies or things to throw, they were continuously resupplied by well-stocked support vehicles. On June 1st, a woman was stopped by police after she was observed allegedly handing out supplies to rioters. She sped off in response, hitting multiple vehicles in the escape. She was only stopped once her tires were slashed by spike strips laid by police. No charges were pursued. In my time on the ground in Portland, I observed sophisticated communication strategies between different Antifa units during the protests. As in Chaz, they communicated via walkie-talkies and sometimes subtle hand signals. Each faction of Antifa served a function they had been trained for. Drivers carried supplies like water bottles, some of which were frozen solid and later used as projectiles against police. Scouts on foot, bicycles or motorcycles watched the perimeter and kept an eye on every person entering the area. Those who looked suspicious were flagged and closely followed or monitored. On several occasions, random people accused of being right-wing were chased out or assaulted by the mob. As the days went on, the weapons became more sophisticated and dangerous. In addition to rocks, concrete chunks, and bottles, they were adding in large commercial-grade fireworks. The explosive mortars were used to distract and confuse police, while others hurled projectiles at them. In some cases, officers close to the explosions suffered burns and hearing problems. What amazed me about the strategic choice of weapons, both purchased and homemade, was how innocuous they looked on camera and to bystanders. For example, one doesn't necessarily register a water bottle as a dangerous and potentially deadly weapon. However, Black Bloc rioters froze them to make them hard as rocks. Taking one to the head could lead to a serious brain injury or death. And intermixed with the plastic bottles were glass bottles and canned food. Other popular weapons were slingshots. Rioters stood hundreds of feet back and fired off marbles and metal ball bearings. On camera, they looked deceptively like children's toys. And the umbrellas rioters used to shield themselves from cameras? On at least one confirmed occasion, and likely more, Rioters attached blades to the tips of the umbrellas so they could double as weapons. Lawfare. One of the most effective ways we've seen law enforcement agencies brought to their knees is through frivolous lawsuits bankrolled by endless donors. Lawfare refers to the act of abusing the legal system to achieve goals. There exist large networks of far-left attorneys and legal groups who bring endless lawsuits in an attempt to defund, cripple, and embarrass police. In early June 2020, far-left BLM-style group Don't Shoot Portland filed a class-action lawsuit against the city to stop the use of tear gas. The group is headed by Portland mayoral write-in candidate Teresa Rayford. Rayford advocates for the literal abolishment of police and is one of the few political candidates who garner the support of some militant Antifa. One of the attorneys on the case is Juan Chavez, a lawyer with the far-left Oregon Justice Resource Center. The group takes cases representing Antifa and far-left clients. Chavez is also a prominent member of the National Lawyers Guild, NLG, a legal group with historical ties to the Communist Party. It has chapters across the United States. The organization formally declared its support for Antifa and political violence in a statement on its website in 2017. While many abhor tactics that involve violence, historical evidence shows that direct action has contributed to shutting down fascist movements before they gain too much power or influence. In effect, the NLG is the legal arm of Antifa. Its 2016 non-profit tax form shows it pulled in over $711,000. The NLG's executive director, Pooja Gehi, identifies as an anarchist. The organization provides green hat-wearing legal observers at left-wing riots and protests. Even before COVID-19, they frequently hid their identities by wearing masks. The volunteers appear to be neutral legal observers, but in fact, they are only there to record out-of-context videos to use in lawsuits against police or their political opponents. They do not film Antifa. By October 2020, in Portland alone, there were 21 protest-related lawsuits filed against Portland police. As chaos occurred night after night on the streets of Portland, the Portland Police Bureau, PPB, was convulsed by another high-level resignation. 1 week into June 2020, Portland Police Chief Jamie Resch resigned. She wasn't even 6 months into her position, which she took over from Danielle Outlaw. Outlaw, a black woman, was hired by Mayor Wheeler in 2017. Wheeler and the city's progressive left assume she would prioritize her black and female identity. Instead, she performed the job of a police chief of a major American city, maintaining law and order. This earned her the ire and hatred of Antifa, who frequently called her a race traitor. The local left-wing press regularly demonized her as the overseer of a department that was too aggressive with left-wing protesters. In November 2018, left-wing paper Willamette Week published a cover story on Outlaw that showed her as an ugly cartoon caricature with exaggerated facial features. The Portland Police Association released a statement calling the profile racist. Outlaw resigned from the Bureau at the end of December 2019 to become the new commissioner of the Philadelphia Police Department. Sources tell me Outlaw tried to restore order to Portland during mass street brawls throughout 2017 and 2018, involving Antifa and right-wing groups, but she did not have the support of city council. Politicians in the city are terrified of political and media backlash for holding Antifa and far-left protesters accountable. The local and national media are staunchly on the side of Antifa, regardless of their violence against police and property. Resch, Outlaw's replacement, resigned 2 weeks after George Floyd-inspired riots began in May 2020. Resch is white, and the rumour among beat cops is that Mayor Wheeler wanted a black person in charge of police. Resch's replacement, the third police chief in Portland within 6 months, was Charles Chuck Lovell, a black lieutenant in the PPB. Lovell's leadership has not been welcomed by the city's BLM Antifa Brigade. They too view him as a race traitor. By September 2020, Wheeler publicly voiced his disapproval of Lovell after the PPB released a statement criticizing his draconian tear gas ban. Send in the feds. Week after week in June 2020, the riots continued to escalate outside the Justice Center. The weak fence set up by the city was easily torn down and cut open by rioters. Eventually, the city removed it altogether. Lounsdale Square and Chapman Square, two adjacent parks in front of the Justice Center and the Mark O. Hatfield Federal Courthouse, became the operations center for Antifa. There, the numerous Antifa pop-up groups set up tents that supplied rioters with everything they needed. Though nearly 280 people were arrested throughout May and June, almost all of them were quickly released without bail or conditions, even when they violently resisted arrest and were found to be carrying weapons. COVID-19 policies for the county meant that only the most egregious suspects were held in jail, but even then, they were quickly bailed out by the bail fund. Rioters would simply return to riot again, sometimes within the same day, and face no consequences for subsequent arrests. Within less than 2 weeks, there were nearly 100 arson fires in and around downtown Portland. Despite the violence and vandalism, a federal judge temporarily banned the PPB from using tear gas. The response from elected city officials was to deny the violence and praise the protests. After the first night of mass looting, arson and violence, Mayor Wheeler tweeted, "We talked about agitation. Yes, even violent agitation, and how it has historically occurred with purpose and resulted in change that has moved this country forward." Though most of the rioting focused on attacking the Justice Center and the Central Police Station it houses, by late June, rioters were increasingly turning their violent attention to the neighboring federal courthouse. Rioters first tagged every inch of the building's front with extremist Antifa slogans and anti-police messages. They smashed the windows on a few occasions, leading to the front glass doors and windows being boarded up with wooden planks. But for the most part, the Justice Center, a county property, was the focus of violence. Then, in July, the mob's attention fully switched to the federal courthouse with an intensity not previously seen. They first began launching commercial-grade aerial fireworks at the building in an attempt to set it on fire. On July 2, 2020, they shattered a front window and tried to gain entry inside the courthouse. They were repelled by officers from the Federal Protective Service, FPS, a law enforcement agency within the Department of Homeland Security, DHS. The following day, they forcibly tore off the protective wooden planks to firebomb the lobby of the courthouse. Federal officers were forced to extinguish the flames. A 19-year-old affiliated with the Youth Liberation Front tried to barricade officers inside to prevent them from responding to rioters who were setting the building on fire. The front door shattered. He was the only one arrested that night. On the 4th of July, the violence escalated to unprecedented levels. That day, around 1,000 people surrounded the building, throwing rocks and explosives. They disabled the security cameras around the building using hammers, spray paint, and paintballs. Several in the mob openly carried rifles and handguns. One of the men arrested at the riot was Antifa shooter Michael Reinol. He was carrying an illegal firearm and resisted arrest, requiring three Portland police officers to be subdued. However, he was only cited and released because he claimed to be injured. His criminal charges were later dropped by the Multnomah County District Attorney. Reinol went on to kill a Trump supporter the following month in downtown Portland. By now, a surge of federal officers from the FPS, U.S. Marshal Service, U.S. Border Patrol, and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, were on call to protect the federal courthouse. Under Mayor Wheeler's orders, local police were not allowed to aid in protecting federal property. On July 5, 2020, hundreds returned to again attack federal officers, and they tried to burn down the courthouse. They also assaulted construction crews who were working around the clock to replace wooden barriers that were torn down. Christopher Fellini, 31, was arrested that night and charged with assaulting a federal officer. In his possession, officers found a knife, pepper spray, and a powerful laser. Fellini was previously arrested and charged at another Portland Antifa riot in 2017. Another arrestee that night was Andrew Stephen Faulkner, 24, who was also accused of assaulting a federal officer. During his arrest, he was found carrying pipe bomb components and a sheathed machete. For the next 4 weeks, Antifa's plan of escalating attacks on federal property to provoke a federal response for the cameras produced the exact propaganda they wanted. On any given night, there were dozens who identified as press. At its peak, there were probably more than 100 journalists and live streamers, most of whom were sympathetic to the rioters and protesters. Instinctively, and at the urging or demand of others, their cameras were trained solely on law enforcement to capture their every move. Those who ran afoul of Antifa's rules were forced out or assaulted and robbed. Left-wing live streamer Tristan Taylor was beaten to the ground and had his recording equipment stolen. Every use of force by officers, whether it be tear gas, smoke, pepper balls, or arrests, was heavily scrutinized. Out-of-context video snippets were released on social media and published by news outlets, generating mass rage and universally negative press for law enforcement and the Trump administration. The officers were called Trump's Gestapo, stormtroopers, and thugs by Democratic politicians and the media. Erin Smith, a conservative trans woman and writer who goes undercover at large Antifa riots on the West Coast, says Antifa use a calibrated level of violence to provoke reactions by law enforcement for propaganda purposes. Antifa seek to force law enforcement into a dilemma action where there are simply no good responses from a public relations standpoint, Smith told me via email. They either fail to respond to Antifa harassment and look weak, or react in ways likely to be perceived by the casual observer as an overreaction. Both choices undermine the legitimacy of the state and its security forces. As useful idiots for Antifa, the press predictably published reports that help provoke more hatred for law enforcement in Portland. Trump sent cops to Portland and they're kidnapping people off the streets, read a Vice News headline. It was like being preyed upon. Portland protesters say federal officers in unmarked vans are detaining them, read another from the Washington Post. All these stories based on Antifa talking points were meant to create an impression that Trump had literally sent secret police to disappear left-wing opposition. It was false. Using unmarked vehicles to make targeted arrests is neither illegal nor unusual. Every law enforcement agency around the world uses unmarked vehicles. When officers had attempted the usual route of moving in to physically arrest someone, they were mobbed by rioters who Dee arrested their comrades by surrounding police and pulling them away. Accusations of their being secret police and unidentified federal agents were false. Every officer wore official uniforms that displayed their agency via badges on the shoulders with clear words on the front that read, Police. That politicians and journalists did not or pretended not to recognize the uniforms is not an excuse. And no one was ever disappeared. All those detained were properly processed and read their Miranda rights. Most were released within hours. As bad as the riots already were, city council and local politicians actively worked to undermine the federal government's attempts to protect federal property. In effect, they were co-belligerents with Antifa in their uprising. When Acting Secretary Chad Wolf of DHS flew to Portland from Washington, D.C. in mid-July to survey the extent of the violence and destruction, local officials preemptively refused to meet with him. We're aware that DHS leadership is here. We wish they weren't, tweeted Mayor Wheeler. We haven't been invited to meet with them, and if we were, we would decline. Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden called federal officers an occupying army. Oregon Governor Kate Brown echoed and amplified the false media headlines. This is a democracy, not a dictatorship. We cannot have secret police abducting people in unmarked vehicles, Governor Brown tweeted. By mid-July, the Portland City Council officially banned Portland police from cooperating in any way with federal law enforcement. The anti-police and anti-Trump echo chamber involving Antifa, the media, and local politicians brought Portland into international headlines. With that, protesters from the region and around the country descended on the city. Gatherings in front of the federal courthouse swelled from a couple hundred to more than 5,000. Antifa now had the perfect opportunity to carry out attacks they planned using huge numbers of protesters as human shields. It worked incredibly well. When I was undercover on the ground, what I saw was a literal war zone with armed belligerents. On the side of Antifa were units of fighters with explosive fireworks, lasers, rocks, and loaded slingshots. They were joined by street medics, resuppliers, tear gas leaf blowers, and human shields. Many were dressed in riot gear and gas masks. Perhaps the most important faction was those labelled peaceful protesters. They stood arm in arm in the front to shield everyone behind them. The photographs of the wall of mums, dads, and veterans against federal officers were propaganda. The peaceful protesters were used as human shields to deter or delay law enforcement from taking action. It was incredibly effective. When officers inevitably responded, following hours of assaults and property damage, photographers were ready to capture mums being tear-gassed. These were the photos published around the world. However, many of the so-called mums were young Antifa women who simply put on yellow T-shirts. Yellow became the colour associated with the wall of mums. I recognised some of them from their distinct glasses or hair colours as regular black block rioters from previous nights. And on many occasions, the mums were caught on camera participating in violent rioting, such as giving out concrete to throw or helping to tear down the fence. In mid-July, the federal government put up a strong reinforced barrier around the courthouse. Other barriers previously put up were quickly torn apart. This one was made of thick steel, and it was reinforced by concrete blocks on the other side. The fence withstood for many days, but on the 59th night of rioting, hundreds gathered with tools and equipment to bring down the barrier. They used electric saws to cut into the fence, but the holes they made were too small for people to fit through. Next, they tied rope around strategic points of the fence, and hundreds of rioters participated in pulling it down. Heave ho! they shouted. It eventually worked. One section on the south end buckled under the collective force of hundreds of rioters. Officers inside the courthouse rushed out to fire tear gas to prevent a mob from rushing the building. Those accused of committing serious crimes throughout the downtown riots included a 43-year-old convicted of possessing child pornography named Blake David Hamp. On July 25th, 2020, he was filmed in a live-stream video allegedly stabbing black conservative activist Andrew Duncombe with a knife near the federal courthouse. Originally from New Hampshire, Hamp has a prior conviction for possession of child sex abuse images. I have seen him at various protests wearing bright children's themed clothing, but he was far from childlike or innocent. Hamp is extremely confrontational and threatens others he perceives as right-wing. He was one of the people who confronted me before I was beaten in June 2019. Hamp was held on a $250,000 second-degree felony assault charge, but was bailed out within days by a left-wing bail fund. He pleaded not guilty to the assault. Another arrestee was a 23-year-old Texan who was filmed barricading the door of the federal courthouse with his body while prepping for an overhead strike using a hammer. The officers broke his hold, and one U.S. Marshal Service deputy was struck three times with a hammer. Then there was an 18-year-old who was caught on a livestream video throwing an object that exploded in a large blast in front of the courthouse. The explosion could be heard blocks away. He was outed by his Trump-loving grandmother, who recognized him from viral video and photos. He's been federally charged over the incident. One new phenomenon that developed over the weeks of rioting was Antifa activists masquerading as press in order to avoid being arrested by police or to get closer to them to throw projectiles. They simply printed out homemade media badges and wrote "press" on their clothing. On multiple occasions, they were seen participating in violence themselves, such as throwing rocks and fireworks at officers or blinding them with flashlights. Sometimes they actively provoked the police into arresting them so their comrades could record video and send out tweets about police targeting media. This was effective, and the ACLU of Oregon sued Portland police and federal agents on behalf of left-wing legal observers and journalists in July. A federal judge granted an emergency injunction, exempting anyone who identified as a journalist from dispersal orders. The injunction immediately did exactly what one would expect it to. Any rioter wanting to avoid arrest simply self-identified as press. By the end of July 2020, Deputy Secretary Ken Cuccinelli of DHS reported to Congress at a U.S. Senate hearing. He said that at least 277 injuries had been inflicted on about 140 federal agents in Portland alone. Agents suffered concussions, burns, and other injuries from being hit with projectiles. The most common injuries were eyesight-related from rioters using high-powered lasers. Rioters also suffered numerous injuries in their clashes with law enforcement. One of the most high-profile incidents caught on video involved a young man who was hit in the head with an impact munition after he threw a canister back at officers. Donovan LaBella suffered a skull fracture and required emergency surgery. After 4 weeks of bloody battles involving nightly Antifa attacks against federal property, Governor Brown announced she had finally agreed on a plan that would see federal officers withdrawn from the city. Under a limited deal negotiated with Oregon State Police, state troopers would take over policing duties in the three-block square of downtown at the center of the riots. After my discussions with VP Pence and others, the federal government has agreed to withdraw federal officers from Portland. They have acted as an occupying force and brought violence, wrote Governor Brown on Twitter. The move was declared a victory by the media. Left-wing protesters and anti-fascists had successfully resisted the federal government and sent them packing. Portland protests calm after federal officers leave the city, read a headline from the Washington Post. Violence subsides after feds exit Portland protests, read another from Forbes. The parachute journalists coming to Portland from Washington, D.C. and New York didn't have their finger on the pulse of the city or Antifa. To them, police and Trump were always to blame, never those who actually organized and initiated violence. Not only did the rioting continue after federal officers withdrew from the courthouse, it became even more violent and bled into other areas of the city. Out of your house, into the streets. On August 8, 2020, hundreds of BLM Antifa protesters shut down the streets of a residential area in North Portland as they marched to the Portland Police Association building. They shined bright lights into homes and apartments. "Out of your house, into the streets," the mob shouted to families in their homes. One person who looked disapprovingly out of his window had a large light shined into his home. "We're going to burn your building down," a protester shouted to the man. "We know where you live," another protester yelled. Soon, the mob made it to the police union hall. They first erected a barricade on North Lombard, a busy North Portland street, using stolen dumpsters and fences from nearby businesses. They then set it on fire. As in downtown, they destroyed the security cameras around the police association building. Before midnight, they smashed their way into the front of the building and set the interior on fire. Their goal, as they have always stated, was to burn down police and government facilities. Responding officers from Portland Police and Oregon State Police were met with a barrage of hurled glass bottles and paint balloons. The violence that night capped off a week of daily BLM Antifa riots that were now becoming entrenched in residential areas on the east side of Portland, far from downtown. The previous night, hundreds of rioters surrounded the Penumbra Kelly building in southeast Portland. They threw concrete chunks and explosives at police. Responding police cruisers had their tires slashed by rioters who dumped nail-filled pool noodles on the street. On August 6th, the night before, rioters tried to break into the Portland Police East Precinct. Two elderly women who lived nearby tried to stop the mob from setting fire to the building. As one of them used an extinguisher to put out a fire, she was screamed at and harassed. The mob then hurled paint at them. One woman had it thrown in her face and eyes. The 2 days of calm at the end of July and the beginning of August, after federal officers scaled back their presence, were merely the eye of the hurricane. In fact, those 48 hours were used by Antifa to re-strategize and plan their next moves. Without federal officers to fight, they took their riots elsewhere. From August onward, some of the most intense violence yet took place in residential areas of the city. Day to day, BLM Antifa rioters met in parks around Portland, where they would distribute riot gear, food, and extremist literature. They'd train in shield formation tactics to prepare them for the evening's riot. Locations targeted for arson and vandalism primarily rotated among Portland's police's north, east, and southeast police stations. On several occasions, rioters also targeted Mayor Wheeler's condo in a posh part of northwest Portland. By early autumn, they began to regularly attack the local ICE facility. For months, Portlanders had to suffer through a daily nightmare version of Groundhog Day. It was the same every evening. Rioters gathered at a park, marched to a location to attack, were arrested, and were quickly released or bailed out. Rinse and repeat. From May through August 2020, hundreds had been taken into custody by law enforcement. But the result was the same for almost everyone. The Multnomah County District Attorney dropped the charges, even the serious felonies. Asara Butler, the accused riot supplier who, in June, sped off in her car, hitting other vehicles, was originally charged with felony riot, felony failure to perform duties of driver to injured person, felony criminal mischief, felony fleeing, reckless driving, and reckless endangering. Every single charge was dropped. Likewise, an accused arsonist who allegedly admitted to roommate she was part of Antifa had all her charges dismissed. The dropping and dismissal of their felony charges were the norm, not the exception. In the United States, local criminal charges are pursued, or not, by the county's elected district attorney. They have complete discretion to act. Portland's left-wing political monoculture means that the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office has to make politically calculated prosecutions that are favourable to the city's vocal woke populace. Justice is not blind in Portland. Antifa and BLM rioters are let go almost as quickly as they can be processed through jail. From 2013 to 2020, Multnomah County elected and re-elected Rod Underhill to be its district attorney. Underhill is a liberal, and it was reflected in his office's soft approach to crime in the 7 years he was there. However, on August 1, 2020, Underhill stepped down early from office. This opened the way for Mike Schmidt to take the reins as the city convulsed through months of riots. Schmidt, 39, ran and won in a landslide election as a progressive candidate who promised criminal justice reform. 2 weeks before he took office, Schmidt signalled his approach to riots in an interview with Willamette Week, saying, "I think that when you look historically at this nation, it's during these protests when we've gotten some of the changes that we are proudest of in our nation's history. And sometimes it took some property damage. It took more than just peaceful protests to get the government's attention. I'm very mindful of that." 11 days into office, Schmidt announced an official policy regarding riot and protest cases in the county. Under his policy, the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office preemptively declines to prosecute charges of interfering with an officer, disorderly conduct, criminal trespass, escape from law enforcement, and harassment. Felony riot charges are also automatically dropped, unless coupled with a charge not already included on the list. What this means is that Multnomah County essentially decriminalized all crimes short of assault, arson, and property destruction at riots. Those who try to stop police from making arrests, ignore their lawful orders, and escape, they face no legal consequences, even if they are arrested. Further, Schmidt's policy states that charges of resisting arrest and assaulting a public safety officer must be subjected to the highest level of scrutiny by the deputy district attorney reviewing the arrest. That is a softer way of saying assault on police is conditionally allowed. And rioters charged with misdemeanors or felonies where there was only financial harm would be offered conditional dismissal. The announcement exacerbated the riots. Antifa already had practically free rein before, but now it was official policy. On September 1st, 2020, BLM Antifa rioters gathered outside Mayor Wheeler's condo for a second time. As much as Wheeler tried to kowtow to protesters for months, it was never enough. They demanded he resign. That night, they threw explosive fireworks at his building, which houses dozens of other family units. By around 11 p.m, rioters smashed their way in the ground level of a large occupied apartment building. They started a fire inside and stole furniture to start another fire on the street. A riot was declared, and police made 19 arrests. All arrestees were released from jail within a few hours or bailed out. In response to the targeted violence, Mayor Wheeler announced he was moving. Firebombs. On September 5th, rioters marched to attack the East Precinct, as they had done many times before. But that night, they hurled lit firebombs for the first time. Over the previous months, Portland police had confiscated unused Molotov cocktails, but none had actually been used at the riots. However, that night, a masked rioter hurled a firebomb in the direction of a line of police. It fell short of its target and instead landed at the feet of a group of protesters. Two people were set on fire, including one who desperately flailed about and rolled around while his feet were engulfed in flames. Police extinguished the fire and offered him help. For the next 4 hours, rioters continued to light fires on the street and hurled more mortar fireworks at officers. One sergeant was directly hit by an explosive, which burned through his glove, injuring his hand. Officers were struck with rocks. In response to the violence, they used tear gas to disperse rioters. The street, filled with homes and families, was clouded with smoke from fires and tear gas. Over 50 people were arrested that night, including Christina Narayan, the legislative director for Tina Kotek, the Democratic Speaker of the Oregon House. Joseph Robert Sipe, 23, was arrested and charged with first-degree attempted murder, first-degree attempted assault, first-degree arson, and possession of a destructive device. Court documents say he admitted to lighting the wick of a Molotov cocktail and then launching it toward police officers. The district attorney later dropped 3 of the 4 most serious charges. The following week, Mayor Wheeler announced a total ban on the use of tear gas for crowd control. The riots continued into October. The city never put out a full estimate of the costs, but in early July, Portland Police Deputy Chief Chris Davis said there had been an estimated $23 million in damages and lost business. He made the statement only 5 weeks into the protests. The riots continued for at least 4 more months. Between May and October 2020, there were nearly 1,000 protest and riot-related cases in Portland referred to the district attorney's office. Many of the cases involved people who were arrested on numerous occasions. Tracy Lynn Molina, 47, was arrested by Portland police 7 times, for example. Her charges were dropped every time. Of the 978 arrests and citations, over 90% were rejected for prosecution. The main reason given? Out of the interest of justice, whatever that means. Despite accusations of systemic racism and misogyny in the Portland Police Bureau, the majority of those arrested, 77%, have been white and male, 67%. 4 weeks before the November mayoral election, a local poll found incumbent Ted Wheeler trailing by double digits to far-left candidate Sarah Iannarone. In 2019, Iannarone proudly wrote, "I am Antifa," on her Twitter. Those words were later echoed by Willem van Spronsen, an Antifa terrorist who firebombed a Tacoma, Washington ICE facility, and Michael Reinol, the Portland Antifa shooter. She has stood by her outspoken support for Antifa and, in an August 2020 interview with KGW, declined to denounce the violent riots in her city. Peaceful protests, in my opinion, might not necessarily be moving the conversation forward, Iannarone said. She ultimately lost to Wheeler by about 6 percentage points in the November 2020 election, but only because the write-in candidate to her left, Teresa Rayford, received more than 13% of the votes. A few months before the riots began, I offered to put my differences aside to meet off the record with Mayor Wheeler. I believe him to be a misguided but well-intentioned man whose ignorance about Antifa leads him to make poor choices for the city. My request to meet was acknowledged and ignored. On the evening of October 4th, 2020, BLM Antifa rioters marched to the brand new Multnomah County Courthouse. The $324 million project was scheduled to open the following day. There, rioters proceeded to vandalize the building. Police pushed them out of the area, but they simply moved on to City Hall. Six people were arrested that night. One of them was 33-year-old Jeffrey Richard Singer. He was dressed in black block at the time of arrest and charged with felony assault of an officer, felony criminal mischief, interfering with a peace officer, and escape. Like the others, he was quickly released on his own recognizance, without having to pay bail. Though that night was no different than the other 120 violent protests that preceded it in Portland, Singer's name stood out. He's been active in the Portland militant Antifa scene going back years. In 2017, during a public meeting at City Hall, a masked Singer took to the microphone. His tirade was directed at Mayor Wheeler at that moment, but it could have just as easily been directed to every Democrat and every American. "This is Little Beirut, Mayor Wheeler. This is the city of roses, and it has thorns. They're standing behind me," Singer said, pointing his finger at city council, while a black bloc group held an anarchist banner behind him. "You are laying the fucking seeds for an insurrection. It is not a threat, it is a fact. You are building towards something that's gonna blow." They fulfilled their promise. By autumn 2020, cold weather and rain severely affected the turnout of the riots. But that only made those who came more extreme. With smaller numbers, they were better able to carry out hit-and-run-style attacks on businesses and property. On October 11th, rioters shot out the window of the Heroes American Cafe in downtown Portland during a night that also saw the toppling of two statues and the severe vandalism of a nearby museum. Heroes American Cafe is owned by John Jackson, who is black. 3 days before the attack, an Antifa account on Twitter added the cafe to a list of businesses it said are anti-BLM. There are photographs of first responders in the business that they took offense to. After the election, Antifa stepped up their violence, even though it appeared that Democrat presidential nominee Joe Biden had won over Donald Trump. On November 4th, 2020, several hundred Antifa gathered in downtown Portland. Wearing black uniforms and masks, they held a large banner that read, "We don't want Biden, we want revenge." After marching, they proceeded to smash up dozens of businesses and property on West Burnside Street using hammers and other tools. One of the buildings targeted was St. Andre Bessette Church. In response to the riot, Oregon Governor Kate Brown activated the National Guard, a first since riots began 6 months prior. 13 people were arrested. The majority had their charges immediately dropped. The damage to the Catholic Church was so severe that it had to halt its charity work and outreach to the city's large homeless population. The rioting continued. The following day, a mob of Antifa descended on the home of Portland City Council member Dan Ryan and vandalized his house. They were angry he was the swing vote against a city proposal to defund the Portland police. Separately, an Antifa activist set the front of City Hall on fire. Democrats thought they could pacify Antifa by refusing to condemn or even acknowledge them. But they were playing with fire. On November 8th, 2020, several dozen Antifa in black bloc marched to the headquarters of the Multnomah County Democrats' office. They destroyed the building by smashing most of the glass windows. On the building, they spray-painted Fuck Biden, and No Presidents. They drew a symbol of anarchism to make it perfectly clear who was responsible.